Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today I've got a few important pieces of advice. Life is hard. There's no such thing as fair. And feelings are stupid. Yes, your anxiety, your misery, your general downtroddenness about the state of life, all useless. And instead of wallowing in your deepest feelings, you should take the terrible sandwich life offers and slather it up in ketchup. And that's what psychiatrist Dr. Michael Bennett and his daughter, comedy writer Sarah Bennett, say. It's the premise of their new book, Bleep Feelings, One Shrink's Practical Advice for Managing All Life's Impossible Problems. Or, as they say, stop asking why you've got weaknesses and start preventing them from turning you into a jerk. Well, the Bennetts join us now in studio to give us possibly a much needed dose of reality. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Okay. Obviously, the actual title of your book is not Bleep Feelings. It's alliterative, so I will allow listeners to fill in the blanks. First of all, Michael Bennett, and Sarah, give me the short story on what was the inspiration for you writing a book that basically undercut our desires to understand our feelings as much as we can.
The title itself came from the way my father sort of starts therapy with new patients. I mean, by the time most people go to a psychiatrist, they've exhausted all other avenues of advice. Their friends don't want to hear it. Their family doesn't want to hear it. Clergy doesn't want to hear it. So it's usually not because the problem is so unbelievably unique and bad. It's because they have a certain solution in their head that's never going to happen. They have a wish instead of a goal. And so they'll schlep to his office. And they've, worked it out with their insurance company, paid a copay, done all this, gone through all the hoops to see a shrink and said what they feel and what they think is important. And then he'll use a smattering of profanity, a phrase like the title of our book. And if they can laugh a little bit and it sort of shocks them, it's sort of the verbal slap in the face, then they're ready to rethink their approach. They're ready to get real about what they can actually do. Okay. As opposed to whatever far-fetched solution they had in mind.
It's also the nature of negative feelings that they say to us, solve me, I'm in pain, there should be an answer, what have I done wrong?
Yeah.
And most of the people I see haven't done anything wrong, they're just in an impossible situation. So as long as they focus on feeling better or solving their problems, they're usually going to make it worse,
mm-hmm.
suggesting that there is something about this that isn't going to get solved.
Okay.
It's usually a shock, and if it can be delivered with a little bit of humor and some implication that now that we've got that out of the way, we can really start thinking about how to make the best of things, that gets things moving.
So in the book you write that given life's cruelty and unfairness, Bleep Feelings believes profanity is a source of comfort, clarity, and strength. It helps to express anger without blame, to be tough in the face of pain, and to share determination without sentimentality. On the other hand, you both write, we don't tolerate the reverent use of truly obscene F-words like fair or feelings. But I guess I'm curious about why is it that you think people do have so much trouble like getting to a point where they can actually deal objectively with the situation that reality has presented to them? I mean, we're emotional beings. We want to feel first, right?
Well,
we want to, and we do, in fact.
As Sarah often says, we are not Vulcan advocates. Feelings are where our spontaneity comes from. Feelings are who we are. But as a lot of work in psychiatry and psychology has shown, negative feelings in particular distort our thinking, make problem solving difficult, make us think that we're more responsible for things than we are. And it is our nature also to feel responsible for things, particularly bad things, which we have nothing to do with.
Yeah.
Life is so much bigger than we are. These things just happen no matter whether you eat the right food, stay healthy, have had lots and lots of therapy, make all the right decisions. You're almost as susceptible to bad luck as anybody else, and there's just a huge amount of it floating around. So correcting the negative feelings that come particularly from bad luck is very important.
Sarah, I mean, Michael's your father. Is this how you were brought up?
In part. I mean, when I was asked if I take his advice, and when I was a teenager, I did not as much, because I think when you're an adolescent, especially like I was, where my day was scheduled to the last minute, I had school from, I felt like, 8 to 8, and then 20 more hours of homework. The only thing that felt like was mine were my feelings. So when my father would say, your feelings aren't important, then more feelings would come forth.
Right. That's inevitable, isn't it?
Exactly. As an adult, you know, with a lot fewer hormones and moodiness in general, I definitely do see the value in what we've written and in his whole approach. And he has given me good advice as an adult, especially when I am in an agitated emotional state. He's gotten a little more tactful instead of just saying, no, that's not important. That's not really effective. I think he's learned that. But I do live under this credo now.
I love how you point out in the book that you grew up in Brookline.
Yes, I did.
Which your mother told you has 2% of the world's psychiatrists.
Right, I know. I can't check this fact. And my mother is a smart woman. I don't mean to say that she's got a Cliff Clavin quality of making things up. But I believe it, if only because it seems like all of Harvard's faculty of their medical school in psychiatry lived in Brookline, at least in the 80s when I grew up.
And possibly today, too.
Right, and possibly today. I mean, you know, I haven't lived in Massachusetts for a long time, but yeah, it seemed that way. And also, you know, all the family friends I grew up with, at least one parent was a psychiatrist or a psychologist, you know. So I buy it. And I'm not the only child of two psychiatrists that I know. I'm not the only child of two psychiatrists from Brookline who went to Temple Israel. I'm not the only child of two psychiatrists who wrote a book with my father from Brookline. Because, so there are a lot of us out there.
Well, the book is Bleep Feelings, again, alliterative F's here, One Shrink's Practical Advice for Managing All Life's Impossible Problems. Michael Bennett and Sarah Bennett co-authored the book. And listeners, I'm wondering, what do you think about, have you visited a therapist or a psychiatrist who kind of gave you this sense of, you know, forget your feelings, bleep your feelings, and just deal with reality as it is? Is this the kind of message that you wish you had received? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And, you know, give us your advice on what you think are better ways of dealing with what reality has presented to us. I mean, you guys actually talk about how the problem isn't reality. It's what we wish for, right? What we think we can do to change. Can you give us some examples?
Well, a lot of times someone can come in and say, you know, I want to have a good relationship with my mother. And if this person's in their 30s and they've always had a turbulent relationship with their mother where they've always butted heads, then there's no reason to believe that either one of these people is going to change. And also, you can't change other people unless, you know, you have magical powers or a gun, frankly. So at that point, that's a wish. A wish to have this good relationship. A goal is to have a peaceful and manageable relationship. And you can set limits that make that possible. You can be careful about how much time you spend together, what topics to avoid. You know, make sure that you avoid any foreseeable conflict. But you're never going to hold hands together and bake cookies. It's just not on the horizon. And wanting it to be there and aiming for it and pushing yourself for it, you're really lining yourself up for disappointment and sadness.
That's why the first chapter we got inspired to write was on jerks, although that's not what we call them.
No,
the spirit of profanity of the book. And it was about how there are people who are easy to love. You find them in your family. You find them at work. And you always, it's a nature of our feelings to think that there's some way to get through, to make things better, to communicate, to establish some common ground or some rules. And with people who are really jerks, that's just not possible. And trying to do that can cause more trouble. So I found in practice that the true jerks don't come for treatment. But they sure send a lot of people
to treatment.
Yeah. And they're one of their main purposes in life seems to be to make a living for psychiatrists.
Well, you know, Sarah, it occurred to me that you're a comedy writer. You spent a couple years writing sketch comedy for the Upright Citizens Brigade in New York. I should ask you, before we get too far into sort of the practical advice that you and your father present in the book, well, let me ask both of you, what was it like actually writing the book together? What was the process like? How did you weave in your skill set with your father's skill set to come up with some pretty great stuff in here, I have to say.
Thanks. Well, you know, for a few years leading up to this, we've written a blog together where people write in with their problems, and we'd sort of worked out a technique. If someone sends in a question, we format it a certain way. My father comes with an answer. I then take that answer, shape it, make it a little more palatable, a little less abrasive, because my father writes like a doctor. It can be like a chart. And when you use shocking language, gentle yet shocking language, to knock people out of their mindset, if you don't do that carefully, it can just read like a very angry, mad person telling you what to do. So I then fix that up. He reads it again. He makes sure that the typos are gone, that there's nothing in there he objects to. And then it's usually done. So this took a long time to figure out, because my father has great ideas, but he hasn't done any writing since college. And so much of writing is just sort of training his ideas into a specific space, you know, getting them into a format so he knows what to say and where. So after years of doing that in the blog, the book, it took a little while to figure out this new format. But once it was there, it was just, I don't know, several months of having an outline and having assignments going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So no, we could not sit in the same room. You know, I always think of the Coen brothers. The story about them is they sit across from at a giant desk across from each other. That to me is a nightmare. But just being in different places in the same house, being in New York and Boston, emailing back and forth, that kept us from killing each other. And I think worked out pretty well.
Well, I think Sarah understates a little bit what she does. We set out to try to capture some of the dramatic nature of some of these conversations. And it's difficult because they depend to some degree on the imagination patients bring to the topic. And the closest thing I could come to in my memory was a good Ann Landers column. So I'd pitch some situations that I'd run into to Sarah, and she's got an uncanny ability to sort of put one or two of these things together and see how they'd play off one another. I don't know where it comes from, but it would give a focus to this. So she says, this is going to work. And so I go back and labor it, turning it into an Ann Landers type of query and response. And if I'm lucky, she would say, okay, we're ready. Now it's time for an introduction. And if I'm unlucky, she'd say, you got it all wrong.
Yeah.
Start over.
Well, I have to say that I just want to share with everyone some of the result of your work together, because I was reading one of the chapters in the book. It's chapter 8, Bleep Parenthood, because what greater thing could we wish that we could control than our children that we actually can't, really? And so you guys write this beautifully. You write, the only way parents can control the traits they pass down to their kids is by using birth control. But after that, all bets are off. That means parents always feel that their kids' issues are their fault, even when there's nothing they can do. If you want to have a child, in order to have a beautiful, permanent experience, just get a tattoo of a dolphin riding a unicorn over a manatee. It will always be with you, stay exactly the way you made it, and bring you the world of joy without ever crashing your car or getting a stupid tattoo of its own. I just thought that was like truer words about parenting I had not yet read. And in fact, I'm impressed I got through it without laughing, because when I read it earlier today, I was like having a fit in our office. It was so funny.
That's the way I felt about it. That's Sarah's prose.
Well, let's take a quick call here. Liz is calling from Beverly. You're on the air, Liz.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I am calling to say I do agree with the title of this book, although not the profanity. When I was much younger, I was going through a terrible divorce, and it was awful, and I was kind of paralyzed about how bad I felt. My father, who is not a psychiatrist but a very wise man, finally said to me, you know, you just have to stop thinking about how you feel about this and do what you need to do the feelings will follow. And he was 100% right. Once I began acting, just kind of what needed to be done, things got better and I did feel better.
Liz, thank you so much for your call. Michael or Sarah, do you have a comment on that?
Well, one of the things also that we emphasize is that as the pain dies away, you also learn so much from a divorce about not about what you did wrong, but much more often about how you just chose wrong. And that can be a great guide to doing better in the future. The sad thing is that as you get better at choosing, you don't necessarily control whether somebody comes along who really meets your minimum requirements. So there's no guarantee that you're going to find Mr. Right, unfortunately, but there's a much better guarantee that you will not embrace Mr. Wrong.
Hmm. Well, we're talking with Michael Bennett and Sarah Bennett. They are co-authors of the new book, Bleep Feelings, One Shrink's Practical Advice for Managing All Life's Impossible Problems. I'm just curious what you both think. You're writing this book in a time where, in a way, I feel as if people's feelings and the validity of them is as present and central to our culture as it has been in a while. I mean, we've on this show, we've done a lot of segments about, you know, creating safe spaces in classrooms, trigger warnings, you know, checking if everyone's okay, just constantly like putting feelings at the forefront of how we engage with the world. I mean, this book seems to be quite a strong pushback against that.
Well, it's not a wholesale rejection of feelings, though. It's feelings and how they affect your decision making and your problem solving. So it's not saying other people's feelings are stupid and we don't have to take any account of someone's experienced trauma or what their history is. But it's saying that you shouldn't let feelings be your guide, essentially. So, I mean, I'm not anti-feelings on a general scale. Again, we make the Star Trek reference to we are not Spock. But if you are feeling terrible, but you still manage to be a good parent, and you still get up and go to work every day, and you're still a good friend, then that's the goal. It's living up to your values and being a good person despite how you feel. I'm not saying I feel terrible, so I'm entitled to do terrible things, or I'm going to let that make the decisions for me. Mm-hmm. Or I feel good, and this makes me feel good, so I'm going to keep doing it. And it could be heroin. That's a bad choice. Good feelings should not guide your decisions in that case. So it's been brought to our attention that this could be contrived as an argument against political correctness, but we see it as totally apolitical, like that there are no politics in this book. It's just common sense.
When a friend of mine, Ned Halliwell, read this, he said, you know, this is a philosophy that really goes back to Samuel Johnson, the great British writer and creator of the first
dictionary.
Yep. And he said you don't realize it, but you're a Johnsonian, and I think he's absolutely right. Beginning around 1800, there was more and more of a celebration of the importance of feelings, and hippies were a modern extension of that, and there is a sense of validity and meaning in being in touch with your feelings. But I think what Johnson was saying and others is that if you don't also hang on to your values, it becomes relatively meaningless. So in that sense, this is a book that goes back to very old roots.
Hmm. Amanda is calling from Rockport. You're on the air, Amanda.
Hi. I just had a question for your guest. I do agree with your point in some senses, but I was wondering how you would respond to a patient who maybe came into your office with clinical depression, where telling them that their feelings are invalid and don't matter might actually cause harm to the situation. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks,
Amanda.
Well, thanks for asking, Amanda. I see a lot of depression in practice, and the statement to the patient isn't that their feelings, their negative feelings, don't matter. It's that the intellectual content is very suspect, that depression tells you that you're worthless, that things won't get better, that what you're doing isn't worthwhile, that you can't socialize or work as well as you should be able to work, that you haven't done well with treatment. The sad news, I have to deliver that I think psychiatry has appreciated over the last 20 or 30 years is that depression often isn't curable. It does tend to come back. Antidepressants and other treatments sometimes don't work or work partially but not completely. But the ultimate message is that those are symptoms, and that if you pursue your values and you try to be a good person and parent and get out to work in spite of having depressed feelings and feeling down and not feeling much like socializing and not having much energy and having trouble concentrating, and you still get yourself going, that's my idea of being a hero.
Mm. Well, in the last couple minutes that we have both of you here, I'm going to ask for some freebie advice that actually comes out of the book and some hypothetical situations or problems that we maybe many of us have to deal with. Because you have a chapter called Bleep Serenity, and you offer advice on how to deal with what you call the inescapably annoying. In the book, you write that unless you find yourself in Guantanamo or a North Korean labor camp, the worst kind of torture you can expect is being obliged to spend time with someone due to family work or just geography whom you hate enough to murder with your bare hands. So your advice on dealing with that.
The essence of that is that good people can sometimes find themselves in that situation for very good reasons. And appreciating that there's no way necessarily in the short run anyway to solve it by talking it out, by finding the right thing to say, by readjusting your own feelings, realizing that sometimes people are like that, sometimes our own feelings are like that, and they just are what they are. And then focusing on trying to get your work done, trying to find a new job, trying to be kind anyway, trying to limit your exposure as much as you can. Those are the practical solutions. And the big deal is not letting it get your morale down, not letting it make you feel like a failure.
Yeah. And what about on the chapter on helpfulness? You say, resist the call to helpfulness and the rush that comes with it unless you're willing to acknowledge its potential to do harm and evil.
Well, I think the scenario that's usually the most helpful to bring up is if you have one child that has special needs in learning, let's say, that if you dive into that and throw yourself into the situation without thinking first, without being careful in your helping, you can do more harm. You can alienate teachers instead of get them on your side. You can neglect your other kids who might have needs as well. You can use up all your resources in terms of your time and your money. And at the end, you will put in all this effort, but because it was sort of blindly throwing yourself into a problem, you did not get the best result.
Yeah.
So it's not, don't help anyone, don't feel anything, you know, all these absolutes. It's do these things thoughtfully and carefully.
And you've also got another chapter called Bleep Self-Improvement. What's so bad about self-improvement? I mean, the book itself, is it not a self-improvement kind of book?
Well, we actually at one point were the number one seller on Amazon, but in emotional self-help. And for a book that sort of claims it's anti-self-help and in its title rejects emotions, seemed like a very odd category to put us in. But I think the main problem with a lot of self-improvement is that it forces people to put the onus for their success squarely on their own shoulders. At least that's what we know from self-help. And really, if you take responsibility for what you don't control, you're setting yourself up for disappointment and feelings of failure that you don't deserve.
Well, there's a lot of practical advice in here on how to avoid that. It's a terrific book. The book is Bleep Feelings, One Shrink's Practical Advice for Managing All Life's Impossible Problems, co-authored by Michael Bennett, a Boston psychiatrist, and Sarah Bennett, a comedy writer in New York and New Hampshire. Thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for the book.
Thanks for having us.
Listeners,
there's more in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.